Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back. Or if you're new around here, hi, my name's Georgia, and on my platforms here on the internet, I talk about true crime and history. And today's case perfectly sits at the intersection of those two things. Today we're going to be delving into the chilling history of Willowbrook State School on Staten Island, New York, an institution shrouded in tragedy and neglect. Willowbrook was a place initially conceived as a beacon of hope for individuals with intellectual disabilities. However, the awful reality would soon become overcrowding, abuse, and just horrific conditions for all of the residents. Some of them would also even become subject to inhumane hepatitis experiments throughout the 50s and 60s, forced to drink chocolate milk mixed with the feces of other infected children in order to study their immunity to hepatitis. Yes, really. From its inception in the 1930s to the eventual closure in the 1980s, Willowbrook still serves as a stark reminder of the injustices faced by some of society's most vulnerable people, both throughout history and still today. For many years, the trauma suffered by those at Willowbrook went unseen by the outside world. That is, until journalist Gerardo Rivera filmed an expose that sent shockwaves around the world. This had a huge impact on disability rights and advocacy, and it continues to shape conversations around institutional care and human rights to this very day. And I guess with a case like this, there's no better place to start than in the very beginning, in 1938, when plans were drawn up to build a specialist facility for children with intellectual disabilities on Staten Island. The original conception of Willowbrook, with its beautiful fairy tale name, undoubtedly did have good intentions. This was the 1930s, and the understanding of intellectual disabilities and just disabilities in general was miles away from what we know today. A perfect example of this is that when the plans were put in for Willowbrook, the legal documents referred to it as a school for mental defectives. When referring to history in this episode, we are going to be using a lot of incredibly outdated and now very, very offensive terms, but this was just the language used at the time, and in order to correctly represent history, we need to share those details. It was widely thought that removing intellectually disabled people, as is the more accepted term today, and placing them in institutions with around-the-clock specialised, and I use that term loosely, care, was the best for everyone involved, families and the person alike. This is what doctors told families, this is what the government told families, this is what everyone around them said. Parents genuinely thought their children would be better off in an institution than at home with them. The construction of Willowbrook wasn't completed until 1942, but obviously that was around the same time the USA joined World War II, and so it was quickly transformed into an army hospital called Halloran General Hospital. When the war eventually came to an end, there were talks of turning it over to the Veterans Administration, but it was ultimately decided that it would go back to its original plans and then turn it into a state school. In October 1947, the New York State Department of Mental Hygiene would officially open Willowbrook, taking in their first residents. Now, Willowbrook was by no means the first of its kind. Institutions like this one had existed for hundreds of years across Europe, and then the USA followed suit. There were hundreds across America, but they were generally much smaller. No one had quite seen anything to the scale of Willowbrook. They could hold thousands of residents. Parents of intellectually disabled children were encouraged to send them away to institutions, and with a huge lack of education, they believed what their doctors were telling them, that their children would receive the best care possible, better than anything the parents could provide at home. And a lot of the doctors did really genuinely believe that, whether right or wrong. You couldn't provide the right therapies at home, they thought. Parents had other children, they had jobs to do, homes to look after. These children were better off being looked after by the experts. Willowbrook wasn't necessarily born out of a want to treat children horrifically. It was meant to be a place of care. But a lack of knowledge, and much more importantly, a severe lack of funding, would lead it down a dark, dark road. And despite this, Willowbrook would remain being one of the only options for a lot of families, and it constantly had a long, long wait list. Like, I'm talking thousands of names, thousands of children waiting to be sent to Willowbrook. Although sending your child to an underfunded institution doesn't seem like the best option today, these parents had no other support, they had no other ways to provide the care their kids needed, and there was also a lot of stigma. Upon its opening, Willowbrook was presented to the public, to the parents, as the perfect place for their children. It was advertised in all the local newspapers alongside photos depicting plenty of staff members tending to healthy-looking residents, smiles and happiness all around. The photos showed the residents receiving therapies, engaging in activities designed to make them productive members of society. And this is the USA, remember, becoming a productive, money-earning member of society is always the end goal. And that is absolutely not meant to be a read before people jump at me, it's just the American dream. Every citizen of the United States should have an equal opportunity to achieve success and prosperity through hard work, determination, and initiative. This was the equal opportunity. But the advertising was false from the outset. Like, even in the early days, there just wasn't enough staff for the amount of residents, of which they just continued accepting more and more. By the early 1950s, it was clear that Willowbrook had a huge problem with overcrowding. By 1953, there were 3,000 residents, 4,000 in 1955, which was the maximum capacity, and soon exceeded 6,000. Not only were there too many residents, but it grew at such a rapid rate, there was no way for staff to adjust to the levels of care needed. There was just one attendant for every 50 children, and the Department of Mental Hygiene just kept cutting that budget. And we're talking children here who require anything from just a small amount of daily assistance to round-the-clock daily care. According to statistics from the time, and a warning for language here, 70% of the children were severely or profoundly retarded, a word that would never be used nowadays, but I'm reading directly from statistics from the time. 60% were not toilet trained, 39% were not ambulatory, 30% had convulsive seizures, and 64% were incapable of feeding themselves. These were children who required so much care, the kind of children who today would receive one-to-one care in the equivalent setting, or at least you'd hope so. For the children who were capable of attending, there were some training programs going on, but it was just bare minimum enough that Willowbrook could officially be called a school. Fewer than 20% of the residents attended any kind of class, meaning that for the most part, all the patients did was just sit around all day, unoccupied, no mental or physical stimulation of any kind. Dr. Jack Hammond, the director of Willowbrook State School, stated, "The overcrowding in the buildings makes care, treatment, supervision, and possible training of the patients difficult, if not impossible. When the patients are up and in the day rooms, they are crowded together, soiling, attacking each other, abusing themselves, and destroying their clothing. At night, in many of the dormitories, the beds must be placed together in order to provide sufficient space for all patients. Therefore, except for one narrow aisle, it is virtually necessary to climb over beds in order to reach the children." And this is the director of Willowbrook admitting this. They had zero budget. So very clearly, Willowbrook just became unable to deal with the amount of residents, and this just went on for decades, the conditions just getting worse and worse as the years passed. Throughout the 1960s, the state of New York was struggling economically, so a hiring freeze was put in place. Willowbrook lost 600 employees through attrition. They were basically forced to cut staff. In the fiscal year of 1971-72, $630 million was given to the Department of Hygiene, which was cut down to $600 million and then again to $580 million. Willowbrook lost another 200 employees, and an already hopeless situation just became impossible. It was later said that for the place to operate effectively, they needed to receive about twice as much money per patient as they already were. They didn't have the budget, they couldn't do it. And I do want to stress here that none of what was happening on the ground at Willowbrook was necessarily the fault of the individual employees, like the staff members working with the children. Sure, the higher ups, you can probably blame them, but the individual sort of like nurses working on the ground, most of them, it wasn't their fault. The majority of the attendants tried to care, but when you're dealing with up to 50 children per person, It's very easy to become overwhelmed. It's just not possible. I mean, most of these children were incapable of feeding themselves, meaning each of them had to be individually fed. Spending the time to feed 50 children a full meal, though, that would take literally all day, and they didn't have the facilities to teach them how to feed themselves. So children would literally have food forced down them in just 2 to 3 minutes in order for staff to stick to targets. And if they weren't doing it in 2 to 3 minutes, it meant there was a kid at the end of the line who was just gonna starve. This force feeding would cause all kinds of problems, including pneumonia, of which countless children would end up dying at Willowbrook. Apparently the staff used to give out cookies and candy just by throwing them on the floor. It was said to be like feeding time at the zoo, but they just didn't have time to hand it out individually. And if they didn't have enough time to feed the children, they certainly didn't have time to dress them. Children would spend their days undressed, left to their own devices, all day, every day. Staff had to come up with innovative ideas as to how to deal with so many children at once, such as developing something that they called cripple carts, wooden rolling carts that were originally used for children with physical disabilities who couldn't use the wheelchairs. Eventually, staff would just squeeze as many children as they possibly could into these carts so they could easily just transport them around the building, but it often meant them just being left parked in the day room for hours on end, just squeezed together. There was no physical or mental stimulation, so who knows what unlocked potential these kids could have had in the correct care. A lot of the staff just did the best with what they had. They simply didn't have the funding or the numbers to provide the care that they knew these kids needed. And once there, many staff members felt they couldn't leave, because if they did leave, who would come next? Like, who wanted this job? Who wanted this trauma? How could they guarantee it wouldn't get any worse if they took a stand and quit? Whilst there was the good staff, there definitely was the bad staff as well, the abusive staff, and if the good staff left, the kids were just left with the bad. So a lot of the staff just became stuck as much as the children did. They tried to raise awareness, but it fell on deaf ears. There was nobody from the outside world coming to help, so they did what they could. Diane Bugliogi, a former employee, would later describe that she was given a thick steel key on her first day at work. She used it to open a heavy steel door and then found two more heavy steel doors behind. As she was walking through, she was wondering what kind of monster are they hiding behind three thick steel doors.
I was given this key on that first day of work. Pretty heavy steel key, as you can see. I was told to go to a certain building and I went there and I opened one door. It was a very heavy metal door. Turned the key, opened it. And I walked a couple of steps and I had to open a second door. I was directed down to the end of the hall. There was another steel door. At 19 years of age, I basically said to myself, what have I gotten myself into? Who is locked behind three steel doors? Pushed the door open, and when I walked in, on the other side of the door were 40 toddlers. And why in God's name were they locked behind three steel doors?
It was like a fortress, these toddlers hidden from the outside world, like intellectual disabilities made them monsters, made them dangerous. As if all of this wasn't already bad enough, in the 1950s, one of the most controversial human experiments in American history was allowed to take place at Willowbrook, the hepatitis experiments. Thanks to a severe lack of toilets, with hundreds of children sharing just one, and a general lack of hygiene of any kind, children literally spending the day smeared with their own feces, disease was pretty rife at Willowbrook, particularly hepatitis and parasites. All of the children, and I mean every single one, who entered the doors at Willowbrook were said to contract hepatitis within just 6 months, meaning this would be the perfect place to test out the potentials of a hepatitis vaccine. Hepatitis has been the cause of countless deaths throughout human history. It's always been a pretty horrific disease to deal with. And although there are multiple different types of hepatitis that we know of, they all tend to affect the liver, and symptoms can include muscle and joint pain, a high temperature, sickness, tiredness, a loss of appetite, tummy pain, dark urine, itchy skin, and yellowing of the eyes. In the years after World War II, there was a lot of interest in hepatitis, and they wanted to find a potential vaccine thanks to 50,000 US soldiers being affected. But they didn't really know much about the disease. Enter Willowbrook. A man called Dr. Saul Krugman, a respected New York pediatrician, and his partner, Dr. Jan Giles, contacted Willowbrook about using their residents to test a preliminary vaccine. Everyone knew that Willowbrook was overrun with the disease, and it was a great idea to get new residents in, give them the vaccine, and see if they contracted it within the 6 months that everyone tended to. Now, of course, most parents aren't going to want to give their children an untested vaccine. I mean, nowadays, vaccine testing has rigorous protocol behind it, very strict rules and regulations to follow. It has to go through so many stages before it is available to humans. But in the 1950s, not so much. Now, Dr. Krugman did know these shaky ethics behind infecting disabled children with a potentially deadly disease. He wrote in the 1958 paper that the decision was not one that was undertaken lightly, and that the strain of hepatitis found at Willowbrook wasn't very severe, and without the vaccine, they were going to get infected anyway, so like, he might as well. He said that any knowledge gained from this would help other Willowbrook students, and besides, it was all sanctioned by the Department of Mental Hygiene. Like, they said it was fine, it's fine, I'm gonna do it anyway. 3 decades on from the original experiment in 1986, Krugman wrote another paper entitled The Willowbrook Hepatitis Studies Revisited, Ethical Aspects, in which he continued to defend his decision to carry out this experiment. He makes a number of points as to why it was all ethical and correct. 1, they were going to get hepatitis anyway. 2, hepatitis was known to be especially mild in 3 to 10 year olds. 3, the artificially induced infection would induce immunity. 4, the children would be admitted to specialist units where they would be isolated from all the other infections happening around Willowbrook. And 5, the parents gave consent. They were allowed to ask questions, they could have a tour, they could withdraw their children at any time. So it must have been fine, right? Well, as I mentioned earlier, despite its horrors, Willowbrook had a huge wait list, and Krugman had to have children who weren't already infected for the purposes of his experiment. He offered parents on the wait list the option to have their children jump to the very front of the list, and to have them placed in the newer, cleaner wards at Willowbrook, in exchange for their participation. One mother would later say to Leah Rosenbaum for Forbes magazine that she was desperate and felt coerced. She was being denied help for her daughter unless she agreed to sign the consent form. She didn't know how to tend to her daughter's very specific needs at home, and she was being told again and again by doctors that Willowbrook would be the best place for her. She also remembered being told that her daughter would get an antidote to hepatitis if she took part, and when she asked why the studies couldn't be done on monkeys, she was told it was too expensive. Yeah, as always, it all comes down to money. Using children to save some money instead of spending a little bit more and just do the studies on primates. Like, I know animal testing is a huge contentious thing anyway, but when you're talking primates versus children, I don't know. Like, the only reason Krugman and the Department of Mental Hygiene wanted to use the Willowbrook children to do this experiment on instead of primates was to save money. Like, it wasn't any ethical quandary, they just wanted to save some money. So yeah, they found children on the waitlist whose parents were desperate. They told the parents, if you agree to let your children be a part of this experiment, they will get the nicest rooms at Willowbrook. They'll be treated like kings and queens. You just need to allow us to do medical experiments on them. Krugman and his team would run several experiments on these children to try and create a vaccine. They would give them gamma globulin injections, which is a type of antibody containing blood plasma from those who had already recovered from hepatitis, put into those who had not yet been infected, in order to sort of induce some kind of immunity. Other experiments exposed children to hepatitis with no administered globulin injection, so no previous immunity, whilst others were injected and then exposed to the virus, all under the very watchful eye of the medical team. One of the many ways in which some of the children were exposed to the virus was through the team taking infected feces from other residents and mixing it with chocolate milk, which they then fed to the uninfected children. They fed children feces that they knew was infected with disease. You can't exactly call that a controlled environment, especially when they knew that so many other diseases were rampant in Willowbrook as well. So many parasites. And this is just what we know about, like, this is what they have chosen to share. If they were willing to let children drink poo-infected chocolate milkshakes, what else did they allow? They'd also allow children to recover from hepatitis, then infect them all over again, which just seems unnecessarily cruel. They wanted to see if somebody who had recovered would remain immune or if they could be reinfected. But these were children, and not just children, intellectually disabled children. Krugman insisted until the day he died that he didn't choose Willowbrook so he could take advantage of vulnerable children. He argued that in doing so, in choosing Willowbrook, he actually helped the children there and gave them better living quarters than the other kids, which is a massive red flag in itself, because if you know the rest of the living facilities are subpar, why aren't you doing anything to fix it? Like, why are you like, oh yeah, we treated these children really well, but the rest of them, screw them, they didn't want to be part of the experiment, they can live in squalor. What is perhaps the most frustrating thing about all of this, the hepatitis experiments at Willowbrook, is it did yield results. Krugman discovered the hepatitis A and B strains, and he did definitely speed up the development of a hepatitis B vaccine. But at what cost? In saving some, he put the lives of multiple vulnerable children at risk. Like, are you ever justified in doing that? It's not like he's using adults who had consented, who understood and knew the risks. He used children, and intellectually disabled children at that, who would have had no understanding of what was happening to them. At its very basis, every physician takes an oath to do no harm, and whichever way you look at it, Krugman did violate that. At the time of the experiment, though, there wasn't much outcry. In fact, Krugman was lauded as a genius by his colleagues. He undeniably did make huge advances in the epidemiology field, and not just in hepatitis either. He would also make developments for measles and rubella vaccines during his time at Willowbrook, and he was hugely rewarded for his work. He became the president of the American Paediatric Society, and he received the prestigious Lasker Award. My baseline, though, is this. Despite the fact they were able to successfully create a hepatitis vaccine thanks to this research, the ends never justify the means when it comes to human experimentation, especially when there's so much question over informed consent. I don't know if you're ever justified in inoculating a child with an infectious virus that might kill them, even under controlled conditions. Celebrated vaccinologist Maurice Hilleman has since said that the Willowbrook studies were the most unethical medical experiments ever performed on children in the United States. And that's it really, isn't it? So that all happened in the 1950s, and there wasn't much outcry. Life at Willowbrook just went on. Alongside the hepatitis experiments, there were also programs of research on electroshock therapies, drug therapies, endocrinological studies, genetic diseases, and other communicative diseases such as rubella. Psychologists conducted research on residents' intelligence, therapies involving parents, the effects of institutionalization, and testing and assessment with special populations. Over the years, the conditions would just continue to get worse as the overcrowding did, and the funding was repeatedly cut. In 1965, Senator Robert F. Kennedy paid a visit to Willowbrook and he found inhumane conditions. He said to the waiting media that it was a snake pit where children were living in filth and dirt, less comfortable than in the cages of a zoo.
I visited the state institutions for the mentally retarded, and I think particularly at Willowbrook that we have a situation that borders on a snake pit, and that the children live in filth. But many of our fellow citizens are suffering tremendously because lack of attention, lack of imagination, lack of adequate manpower. There's very little future for the children or for those who are in these institutions. Both need a tremendous overhauling. I'm not saying that those who are the attendants there or the ones that run the institution are at fault. I think all of us are at fault. And I think it's just it's long overdue that something be done about it.
He spoke of the tremendous overhauling that the place needed, and that it was long overdue that something be done about it. But nothing happened. For the general public, they didn't want to be thinking about Willowbrook. It was very much a bury your head in the sand type situation. What you don't know won't hurt you. Some of the parents of the children inside, those who hadn't abandoned their kids, and the staff, though, had long been advocating for change, just trying to make people aware of what was going on. But without more funding, there wasn't anything that could be done. The turning point came around autumn 1971 when Staten Island Advance reporter Jane Curtin published a number of daily articles about what was going on at Willowbrook, for the first time bringing the truth about what was happening to the public. Photojournalist Eric Ertz went to visit the institution with her, and he took a number of very harrowing but powerful photos of what was going on inside. Jane had been contacted by two doctors at Willowbrook, Michael Wilkins and Bill Bronston, who had been screaming into the void for help for a long time now. The pair of them worked in Building 6 with some of the worst conditions imaginable and some of the most disabled children. They were stuck in the same position that so many other employees were. They knew the conditions were terrible, but they didn't have the funding to make it any better. If they left, who knows who would replace them and potentially make it worse. They needed to stay to try and protect the children as they could. They could only try and change things from the inside out. When they contacted Jane, they were overjoyed that she seemed to listen, and they personally let her and Eric in that day to see the conditions for themselves. They were appalled, Jane and Eric, and obviously Jane thought these articles might be the thing that finally brought around change. But no, still, nobody really believed what was going on despite the photo proof. Willowbrook to the Outsiders was a wonderful institution, providing help and hope to struggling parents. They were helping with disabled children. They were good people. Terrible things couldn't be happening at Willowbrook despite multiple people saying that they were. People just brushed Jane and Eric off as radicals. So when the articles themselves didn't have the desired effect, the staff at Willowbrook started encouraging the parents to unionise. And whilst many of the children there had been abandoned and forgotten by their parents, often on the advice of doctors who said that was easier for everyone involved, many of them hadn't been. Many of the kids still had parents who loved them very much. The parents would describe how they'd go to visit their children, but they wouldn't be allowed to ask any questions or see the living conditions. They weren't told what their children were eating, where they were sleeping. There was just this constant air of secrecy. But there was no hiding the smell of feces and unwashed bodies that just permeated everything at Willowbrook. Parents knew something was going on, but they were powerless to do anything about it. But the staff did realise that the only people who were going to be able to actually make a difference were the parents, so they encouraged them to get organised and start planning meetings to discuss what they were going to do. The director of Willowbrook at the time was Dr. Jack Hammond, and he heard about this after he was invited to appear and make a public speech against these conditions. And he refused. And not only that, he then sent a notice round to all employees saying that if they attended the parents' meetings, they would be fired. But Mike and Bill, the two aforementioned doctors, continued to attend, and true to his word, Hammond fired them. However, the administration did forget to get their keys back. So now they didn't have the worry anymore of losing their jobs, it had already happened, so they could really go all out with trying to raise awareness of what was going on. The next day, Mike Wilkins called his friend, journalist Gerardo Rivera, Eyewitness News, and he told him what was going on. And Gerardo agreed to film an expose documentary about the conditions. With the key they still had, they turned up to Building 6 unannounced and just let themselves in one day, film crew and all. What Gerardo would describe was just horrific. There were children lying on the floor, naked and smeared with their own feces. It smelled of filth, disease and death, and he saw things in there he would never be able to forget. He talked of children on the floors, fighting over scraps of paper, screaming for attention. Children who were clearly suffering with huge trauma. As you can probably imagine, once the powers that be at Willowbrook heard about what happened, about journalists coming in and filming, they were not happy. Just 2 days after the unofficial visit, Gerardo was invited back for an official visit, and this time he found children fully clothed, being shown plenty of attention and being properly attended to. Conditions were improved, I mean not good, but improved, and they were assured that this change was definitely permanent. But knowing this likely wasn't the case, Gerardo and his team then turned up for a third time, again unannounced, and the third time they found the conditions exactly the same as the first, just squalor and terror. By the time they got back to the newsroom, there were a number of calls from New York officials accusing them of trespassing, they were threatening lawsuits for violating the privacy of residents, all sorts. But as Bernard Carabello, a resident at Willowbrook for 18 years, would later say, there was no privacy at Willowbrook, it just didn't exist. Like, these journalists coming in and filming it wasn't affected any privacy, because privacy wasn't a thing there.
I was appalled. It was beyond belief how horrible it was, how filthy it was. It was hell on earth. It was really, I mean, I was an experienced person, very urban, very savvy, did all kinds of, drug abuse stories, and I was a tough guy. But when I saw Willowbrook, it was something that seared my soul. The administrators had a colder academic excusing in a way as thinking that we were naive, that there was something that we were missing. And I think that my ignorance was my strength in the sense that I looked at it and said, are you kidding me? I mean, you have children unattended and smeared with their own feces and wailing under the sinks, their pants down around their ankles, eating slop. I mean, what is it that I don't understand?
The condition again was every time they cut the budget more and more.
I got back to the eyewitness newsroom, and there were a barrage of calls from New York State officials angrily denouncing our trespassing and threatening lawsuits and without authorization violated the privacy of the residents.
But there's no privacy anyway.
There was no privacy anyway, very eloquently stated. They lived, everything, all communal. So to his credit, Al Primo, the director of Eyewitness News and the assignment editors said, okay, they suspended judgment. The film came back from the lab. They saw the film. Everyone's spine stiffened, and they said, we're going to go with this story. It changed the world.
Despite the threats from the officials, and I'm talking threats from like New York State, like not Willowbrook itself, like it went above that because New York State were the ones funding this, Eyewitness News decided to go ahead with the story anyway, and they aired it. And finally, for the first time, people paid attention. There was no denying the video footage, the obvious emotions of Geraldo, the lack of care these children were receiving. For the very first time, it seemed like finally something could be done. But what could be done? I mean, money would help, of course, but no amount of money was going to fix what had already happened. No amount of money was going to change the fact that this was essentially a prison for kids, that all these intellectually disabled children and some adults by this point had needs and requirements on all ends of the spectrum. They needed specialized care and help. An institution like Willowbrook was essentially a prison. There was no help for them. No, people realised that Willowbrook needed to be shut down. No amount of money was going to make enough of a change.
But even Bernard, with his tragically eloquent plea for help, doesn't really understand that what Willowbrook needs isn't more money. More money would certainly help. At least the kids would have clothes and they'd be cleaner than they are now, but they'd still basically be human vegetables in a detention camp. What we need is a new approach. We have to change the way we care for our mentally retarded. We ask for change, we demand change. What you've seen here just doesn't have to be this way.
Following the expose, which was named Willowbrook, The Last Disgrace, the parents of 5,000 Willowbrook residents filed a class action federal lawsuit in 1972 to try and improve these conditions. They wanted to get an emergency intervention, and in doing so, they brought in a number of top leaders in the intellectual disability field to talk about what actually caring for people with special needs looked like. Eventually, the trial judge decided that he needed to see it with his own two eyes to really be able to make a decision here. And once he did that, there was no going back. Like, nobody could deny it once they saw it. He was horrified. By this point, they'd even tried to clean it up a little bit, and it was still so awful that on the back of the judge's visit, a Willowbrook consent decree was signed, committing New York State to improve conditions. By this point, they'd actually already changed the name of Willowbrook to the Staten Island Developmental Center, but it just didn't really stick. Like, they wanted to have, like, this image PR overhaul. It wasn't gonna work. In 1975, three significant laws were enacted on the back of Willowbrook, all of which then led to the enactment of the Civil Rights for Institutionalized Persons Act of 1980, protecting the rights of people with disabilities in facilities. And this was the first law of its kind, the first time disabled people in institutions actually had some form of protection. And it's wild to think that they didn't before. Although it's worth saying that the promises made by this law have still been broken time and time again, the residents who escaped Willowbrook, who were sent to other institutions, just continue to deal with mistreatment, some of them still to this very day. The Times reported in 2019 that there have been 97 reported allegations of physical abuse by group home workers against Willowbrook alumni, as well as 34 allegations of psychological abuse and hundreds more of neglect and other mistreatment, like improper use of restraints or seclusion, medication errors, and theft. So it hasn't got any better. Although the expose and lawsuit happened in the early 1970s, Willowbrook would remain in operation for many, many more years. In 1983, it was announced by the state of New York that they did have plans to close Willowbrook, but it would still be a while before that happened. They couldn't exactly just turn the residents out onto the street, they had to find new placements for them, new homes. By the end of March 1986, there were just 250 residents left, down from the 6,000 at one point, and the last children left on the 17th September 1987. Finally, after 50 years, the nightmare had come to an end. Except it hadn't, because for many residents, they'd never be able to forget the horrors they experienced at Willowbrook. One such person who's spoken out a lot over the years and dedicated his life to advocating for disability rights was the aforementioned Bernard Carabeo. He was born with cerebral palsy, but he was misdiagnosed as having an intellectual disability, and he was sent to Willowbrook by his mother, who was a single parent to six children at age three. He would spend the next 18 years trapped within the walls of Willowbrook. He saw everything that went on firsthand. For Bernard and for many others who didn't have intellectual disabilities at Willowbrook, they were actually fully able to comprehend the horrors of what was happening in a way that many of the children with intellectual disabilities might not have been able to. But this was all he knew. Like, he was here from the age of 3 to 21. This was his childhood. In 1972, when Gerardo came in with his team, Bernard was the one to let the cameras in. Being 21 years old now, he was actually able to check himself out, so he went to Bill Bronson's house where they conducted an interview, and Bernard shared his story firsthand. And it's actually one of the most powerful parts of the documentary. I'll leave it linked down below.
How long have you been at Willowbrook?
18 years.
How long were you given physical therapy in school?
5 years.
Are you still going to school?
No.
Why?
I'm over age.
You're too old?
Yes.
Would you like to go back to school?
Yes, I do.
What would you want to learn if you went back to school?
Bring up my reading more.
Learn how to read?
Right.
How is it living on the ward that you live?
Disgrace.
Is it disgrace?
Yes.
Why?
The conditions are getting worse every time they cut the budget more and more.
After that, he never ever returned to Willowbrook again. He was free and decided to dedicate his life to fighting for others like him, inspired by the civil rights movements of the 60s and 70s. To many people, Bernard became a symbol of possibilities, showing the parents of disabled children that there was hope, something that medical professionals rarely shared. Disability of any kind might mean you need to have allowances made. It might mean that your life looks a little bit different from that of abled people. But it's not the be-all and end-all. Disabled people can live full, fulfilled lives, and Bernard became a symbol of that, even after everything he'd been through. I find it truly incredible that after living in such a horrible setting for all his formative years, he was able to come out the other side as such a well-spoken, well-rounded individual. Willowbrook stunted the natural curiosity of so many children, like so many were robbed of their potential, but for Bernard, it seemed to be the opposite, not because of Willowbrook, but in spite of it. In 1980, he accepted a governor-appointed role as advocate for the New York State Office for People with Developmental Disabilities, where he led the fight to protect the rights of disabled New Yorkers. In 1986, he founded the Self-Advocacy Association of New York State, abbreviated to SANES, where he has gone to represent more than 700 individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities living in New York State. After 37 years of this work, he retired, but he remains active in the community. He's still active on the Commissioner's Task Force on Willowbrook. He's wanting to enforce the rights of fellow former residents of the institution. He continues to speak out and advocate for the rights and freedoms of people with disabilities, and in 2020 he received an honorary Doctor of Humane Letters degree from the City University of New York College of Staten Island, which now sits on the land where Willowbrook once stood. It's a very full circle moment. To this day, Bernard and Gerardo Rivera remain very close friends. They describe each other as brothers over anything else. Since the expose, which actually won the prestigious Peabody Award, Geraldo has continued to advocate for the rights of disabled people. That day in Willowbrook changed his life forever. From 1950 to 1980, it's estimated that 12,000 patients, the vast majority of whom were children, died at Willowbrook. That's approximately 400 deaths a year, more than one a day. The causes of death varied, being down to neglect, violence, lack of nutrition, medical management, or experimentation. And there's not loads of records as to the deaths, but for the 1971 fiscal year, Willowbrook recorded 129 deaths, 11 of which were the result of choking, likely due to being fed so quickly, barely allowing any time for children to chew and swallow. Of course, we already know that hepatitis was rife, illness as a whole was rife, intestinal parasites and pneumonia, a huge amount of deaths were also down to them. We can be horrified at Willowbrook and scream and shout about how this should never happen again, but the truth is, it is still happening today. Disability rights still have a very long way to go all around the world. Mistreatment happens at every turn, whether we're talking about something as simple as accessibility or much darker things. A February 2020 article in the New York Times found that many alumni of Willowbrook continue to be abused in much smaller group homes, so history just repeats itself. The research conducted at Willowbrook, the hepatitis experiments, are held up today as an example of unacceptable breaches in human subject research. The scandal that did eventually come on the back of this successfully blocked medical research at Willowbrook through a 1973 US District Court ruling, often cited as one of the main reasons there are now federal ethical guidelines for medical research, so this should never be allowed to happen again. Today, as I said, the University of New York College of Staten Island sits on the former land of Willowbrook, many of the former buildings now holding classes to teach people about how to avoid things like this happening in future, dedicated to educating people. There's also Willowbrook Mile, a memorial walking trail on the former site, designed to be inclusive, progressive, sustainably designed, and universally accessible to all people, no matter ability and needs. What happened at Willowbrook will never change. The past is the past, history is history, but all we can do is hope that going forward, this kind of stuff is never allowed to happen again. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I will see you in the next one. Bye, guys.